Colonel Jackson, wheel number three. Colonel, we were talking about the support given to independent tank movements and the difficulty of supply. What about this question of the trailer?
Yes, the rotor trailer came along, I suppose, about 1939. But there was nothing at that time when the 1st Tank Brigade was operating in the way of a trailer that I can remember. The rotor trailer was a horrible thing. It had fat wheels which contained petrol. I think it was 40 gallons of petrol. And you also carried ammunition and some spare 5-gallon oil drums of oil. But the ammunition used to shake to pieces, and the trailer towed behind the Churchill was made it very difficult to maneuver and was a beastly nuisance all round. We did try in North Africa using the trailer for carrying water, but it wasn't a great success, and we dumped the trailers in a suitable body before very long.
In what year was this trailer introduced, Colonel? Can you recall?
The rotor trailer, as far as I can remember, about 1939. I don't think it was ever used on tank brigade training.
Looking back over those maneuver periods, 32, 33 and 34, what sort of restrictions did you face in these maneuvers?
Restrictions as far as ground, we had to be very careful. Most of the crops at the time, we had the main maneuvers, most of the crops had been gathered, but you still had to be very careful, especially on the the places on Salisbury Plain where racehorses are trained. We don't, under any circumstances, cross those. And there were fences and problems of animals enclosed, and some of the crops were still growing. And you had to be very careful indeed. But if by accident you did make an error, you were always fully supported by your superiors. They would support you through thick and thin if you made a slight error of judgment and came across an irate farmer claiming compensation.
And then there's a frustrating factor to have to face.
It is, and of course it... Well, I suppose it was really no more difficult than the fact that you couldn't really use your weapons or simulate the use of weapons. You were really frustrated by both. The fact that you couldn't go everywhere you wanted to, and the fact that you couldn't simulate fire.
How serious a drawback do you see this to the development of field tactics?
I think as far as movement went, there wasn't a lot of drawback. But I think the failure to simulate the use of weapons probably was a big error. And I think it probably ended in not having a big enough gun when the crunch came in 1939 and 40.
Also, what about the question of having a medley of tanks and different types of vehicles in these operations?
It made a big headache for the administration, who had to arrange supply of spares and the fitters who had to repair the vehicles, but otherwise, I don't think it made a lot of... The biggest drawback was when light tanks and Carlton Lloyds were mixed in a troop in the light battalion, that did limit your range and your maneuverability.
Was this done during the period under review, 32, 34?
I think 33 was about the only time. 34, as far as I can remember, I think we had in the light battalion all light tanks.
What was the aim of mixing in this way, Colonel?
Purely supply. The light tanks were not available.
What about the difficulties of terrain, covering terrain by these vehicles? Were they good or bad or indifferent?
On the whole, they managed very well, but they had their limitations. Cross-country, the Carden Lloyd was really very little use. Light tank was magnificent at most things, provided you went at it, and as the cavalry used to say, your heart must be over the jump. But I don't think there were any problems really which would make any difference to training.
How did you assess whether the ground could take your vehicle?
Yes, we at the time we manoeuvred, it was usually summer, and the ground was fairly hard. Otherwise, if you have a problem over a ploughed field and or a lot of water and mud, the only way to do it is to either prod it and see how soft it is, or use the back of your boot and just feel the thing, and then have a go.
I believe you used to use the stick, which is now used in the.
That was the object of the ash plant in there, which was carried by officers of the Royal Tank Corps and Tank Regiment for prodding the ground, for a reconnaissance officer to prod the ground before leading tanks forward into the assembly area and the prior to the attack.
And this has been retained as a tradition.
Yeah, and the ash plant is still carried by all Royal Tank Regiment officers.
In these years on Salisbury Plain, how much night driving did you do?
We did a lot of night driving. In fact, on some exercises, we were almost entirely operating at night with and lying up during the day. There was really, we really got very used to it, and we were operating without lights in the maneuver area, which must have made it extremely difficult for the other traffic, but there wasn't very much other traffic. So, and I can't recollect any nasty accidents.
A bit unnerving, though, if you were near to other tanks.
Yes, it was most unnerving. Especially if you were in a Carden Lloyd moving in a fast-moving medium column. It really was very frightening. One error of judgment and things would have gone very badly with you.
But you can't recall any serious accidents at night-time driving?
I can't recall any serious accidents caused by night driving.
What about the difficulty of map reading?
We had to get to a very high standard of map reading because in the tank brigade, Brigadier Hubbard wouldn't allow one-inch maps. He made us work on quarter-inch maps, which was very difficult and almost impossible on occasion. But we used to get hold of one-inch maps of the area and have a jolly good look at them before the exercise. And in fact, we used to layer them, that is, bring out the various contours, so that we knew pretty well what the problem was and if you could conceal a 1-inch map in the vehicle. I expect it was done on quite a number of occasions, but you could do a lot with the 1/4 inch. I remember on one exercise the light battalion had to take up a position and cut some roads in the area south of Middle Wallop, and my section managed to do a bit of work by following some tracks, and we came out on the main Middle Wallop Salisbury Road just at the same moment as Brigadier Hubbard came up in his car. He was most suspicious. He was delighted that we had got there, but he was most suspicious as to how we had got there. But he didn't find out.
Colonel, why was he opposed to using 1-inch maps?
Well, it made you think and memorize. If you looked at the 1-inch map before and got some idea of the tracks and the layout of the country over which you knew you were going to operate, it meant you had a jolly good look at the country on a map before you went out. But the 1/4-inch map gave you a broader view. You got a much wider impression of the country as a whole that you were operating in.
How did you manage in night exercises?
With the small map?
Yes.
It was difficult, but especially in the light battalion, where you were usually pioneering the routes, well, we managed all right. There was I can't recollect any awful errors of map reading.
Was any use ever made in this period of a searchlight on a tank?
Yes. I think it was about 1934-35. Somebody in the light battalion conceived the idea of mounting a headlamp on the Vickers gun mounting. And that was a great success. Searchlights on other tanks, I can't remember any. On the mediums, I think there was one that I can remember that had a searchlight on it, but as a whole, I don't think there were any on the medium. They may have followed the example of the light battalion and mounted headlamps on their guns. I can't remember that. They were very useful for picking out things, especially going cross country.
I gather there was some opposition to searchlights. Is this the case? Do you recall?
I can't recollect any, because we used them very sparingly. There was no free use of them, but they were very useful in a tight corner. No, I can't recollect any opposition.
Colonel, in 1935, I believe it was, you were posted to Egypt.
Yes, after the manoeuvre season. I did the manoeuvres with the tank brigade and then went off to Egypt in the November to join the 6th Battalion. And there I was with B Company, who at that time were light tanks. We only had 2 companies, B and C. B was formed from the 3rd Armoured Car Company and C from the 5th Armoured Car Company. And C was a mixed battalion, mediums and light tanks.
What position and rank did you hold then, by then?
I was a section leader, that is, what corresponds now to a troop commander.
And what rank did you hold then?
I can't really recollect. Lieutenant. Yes, because it was before 1938.
Hmm. What about accommodation out there? Was it of good quality in Egypt?
Yes, accommodation really was very good. The barracks were French barracks in Abbasia, just outside Cairo. They were rather a problem over bugs, but we had to have a day a week set aside for anti-bug work when we went with blow lamps round all the beds in the barrack rooms. But our accommodation in the Austin mess in Haking House was excellent.
This was brick built in effect, was it?
Do you mind?
What were the training facilities like in Egypt, Colonel?
Of course, they were really very good indeed. And very soon after I arrived, the whole battalion moved out to Mirza Matru. And of course there, training was unlimited as far as the tactical exercises went. The mobile division was formed from elements of the 5th Division and the British forces in Egypt. And a company of the 4th Tanks and the 1st Light Battalion came out from England and to form this, what we called the Mobile Force. And we did a certain number of operations with them. The infantry, of course, were very interested in anti-tank defense. And they dug a tank ditch around Mirza Matru, and they asked us to test it. And we went out with a light tank company and came back towards the town. And we came across some of the infantry and asked them where the ditch was. And of course, they pointed out that we'd just crossed it, and it wasn't a howling success in the ditch, but they soon learned to the crossing capacity of a light and a medium, and were able to do better things in the future.
Were you impressed with the mobile force?
It did operate very well indeed, yes. We did a lot of operations quite widely ranging in the desert area. The desert was very difficult going in a large number of places. It was pebbles and rocks, which played havoc with the tank tracks. We did a lot of night exercises. As far as we were concerned with the light tanks, it was quite difficult going because there were quite a number of Bedouin encampments around. You had to keep your head out of the turret. You could smell the Bedouin encampment long before you hit it. And of course, there were a lot of dogs barking and things like that, which did help. But we got very good at operating at night.
So it wasn't quite as bad as working on Salisbury Plain?
No, you had free access.
Did you adapt the tank and the light tanks for this surface in any way?
No, there was nothing you could really do to alter that. It wasn't any good putting what we later on called spuds, and what they called spuds in the First World War, extensions to the track. Because they would just have been smashed off by the rocky going. It wasn't too bad on the whole. We did have a lot of track trouble. But the tanks took it remarkably well. The bee vehicles were more trouble over filtering of the sand, and they had no air filters, and it was devastating for the wear of the engine. But the light tanks and the mediums stood it very much better.
What about the question of finding one's direction in the desert?
That was always a problem. We had no tank compasses, but we did improvise sun compasses. In fact, the 6th Battalion had rather pioneered the sun compass work, and in normal times, the officers and parties were constantly going out into the desert on sort of holiday exercises, and from that they learnt an enormous amount, which came, which was put to very good use with the long-distance desert patrols in the war. And the sun compass was one of the things that came out of that. You could improvise, that is, if you stick up a pickhill or any upright piece of the body, set your vehicle in the direction you wanted to go by a prismatic compass, mark on the vehicle the shadow from the sun, and go off in a straight line, keeping the shadow on the mark for a quarter of an hour, and then checking up again. But the sun compass itself, they used to use what were called azimuth tables, the azimuth being the true bearing of the sun. And really all it was a plate bolted to the vehicle with degrees marked 0 to 360 anti-clockwise on the base, and a moving plate which was marked out in the time taken from the azimuth tables, and a gnomon or upright. And you then you then use the sun shadow. You found the correct time, because east of Greenwich it's 4 minutes per degree, and you found the correct time, and from those three you could work, you could set your course, and it was very flexible. You could use it too for changing direction and reading the degrees you were going off, because most navigation was dead reckoning. You use the odometer, that is the mileage thing on the speedometer, and went for so many miles or so many furlongs or whatever you were working on at the degree, and plotted it on a bit of paper. And if you had to deviate, you made the deviation on the piece of paper. With the sun compass, you could do it without stopping. But with a prismatic compass, it's quite a laborious business.
So easily put, I suppose it's something like a sundial fixed to the tank.
Exactly, yes. Mm. More sophisticated instruments were produced officially, and I believe you can still get them through ordnance channels, the Cole sun compass. The Evans Loam sun compass also, I think, was produced just before the war. That was the design of a major and the 8th Hussars, Evans Loom, which was very similar to the homemade ones that you could just knock up by the fitters.
What was the name of that again, Carol?
EVANSLOMBE, Evans Loom.
Yes. Hmm. But it was made, the Sun Compass, by the 6th Battalion, you're saying. In effect, they pioneered it,
but they didn't invent it, of course.
No.
We got the azimuth tables were navigational tables, which were reasonably easy to get hold of for that latitude. They vary with the latitude, of course.
Was it a group effort, or was it did one or two people stand out in the development of this Sun Compass?
One or two people who did pioneer it. There was, as far as we were concerned, it was Captain Harding Newman, whom I think you're going to interview. There were quite a number of people who used to go off on these desert trips and produce these things. The signals, the Royal Signals also had a great interest. I rather think they did initiate the whole thing.